Revenue Committee.
Welcome, everybody, here. We'll start at the bottom of the agenda today, before we get back to 3942 and 2717. We've invited Lori Wimmer and friends. I see Rich back there, who asked for some time in front of the committee to talk to us in the middle of all of our tax bills about some policy issues you wanted to address the committee on, so I will welcome you to come forward.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hass.
Does the Revenue Committee have some sort of bylaw that says when a bill passes unanimously and the carrier that bill carries it and then votes against it on the floor, and a violation?
That just shows that we're not dogmatic, that we're flexible.
That's my fiduciary duty. I did my best to get other people to vote for the bill.
And then he walked over and had a quiet conversation with Representative Butler and came back and punched red. I like that. All right. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, and today with the Fiscal Education Project. And we are here today to kind of unveil for you something we've been working on since session began. We being a list of folks you'll be getting on a piece of buff-colored paper that include a wide range of groups, ranging from the Oregon Healthcare Association to the American Association of University Women, Oregon State Firefighters Council, Oregon School Boards Association, League of Oregon Cities, Human Services Coalition of Oregon, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, Oregon Student Association, Oregon AFSCME, Oregon Education Association, Oregon School Employees Association, Oregon Public Employees Union, SEIU, and AFT Oregon and Association of Western Paper and Pulp Workers. What we are is a group that has begun to form around a single message for you today, but with hope we'll be going well beyond that. And our message is this: no new tax cuts. What you have in front of you here is my file of all the bills up through about mid-March that were filed this session alone that represent some form of tax expenditure proposal. New, not extensions of sunsets on existing, but new tax cuts. You also have a green sheet that gives a list of all of those that I had had in my bill tracking report as of March 16th. And a third page on that handout also has a price tag for as many of them as we could persuade LRO to prepare for us by this date, just to give you an idea of some of the dollars we're talking about. The reason we are here to ask this committee and the legislature in general to just say no to further tax cuts is that, I'll give you a little background. In 1997-99, the Oregon Tax Expenditure Report reported that of every dollar collected in taxes, 50% of it was given away in one form of tax cut or another. Now, as of the last tax expenditure report, that is up to 54 cents. That is to say, only 46 cents of every tax dollar collected actually funds the highly valued core services and programs that Oregonians have come to expect from state government and also local government. What we would like to say is that you often don't get to see the whole as you sit in deliberation of individual tax cut proposals and you consider the policy objectives behind each and every one of them. Sometimes you don't get to see what we see down in the trenches, which is the entire quilt, which is all of the proposals together and what kind of impact they might have, to say nothing of those that already exist in Oregon statutes. Now, we would like to offer one proviso. Were the more significant tax reform packages, such as the one the chair has offered, actually moved through the system, we would ask that you not consider this message in any way in conflict with or a comment on that. We understand that a wholesale tax reform package might be a different thing. But ours was a coalition that formed around the current circumstances with the tax code under current law, the way it is, and the proposals that have come through the bill set. What we're asking is for you to consider that the harm that's done to individual tax cuts, one cut at a time, actually reduces the tax base. And what that does is it means that fewer and fewer Oregonians are asked to shoulder a greater and greater share of the load, which has all kinds of long-term political ramifications, and I think we've all experienced that in the last decade. not only does it render the state a little bit helpless against the resource scarcity issues, which all of you are grappling right now, but it also means that the economy itself for the long term is harmed, because we believe that the investment in a healthy economy is also an investment in the roads and the schools and so forth that this tax base supports. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Rich Peppers, who's going to take the next piece of this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rich Peppers. I'm with the Oregon Public Employees Union, SEIU Local 503, and also here as part of the coalition, the Fiscal Education Project. And my role in this presentation is simply to ask you to bear in mind some of the considerations that should come up as you get these proposals for additional tax cuts or tax exemptions in front of you. One of the arguments that you'll often hear is that there's been excessive growth in government and or a part of government. And I think that that's a complicated area. We would want to caution against oversimplification. And we think, for instance, in the last campaign cycle, there were radio ads as part of one of the ballot measures that made a huge deal out of some of the budgets, or at least one of the budgets in the state. And so what we wanted to make sure is one of the points that we hopefully bring home, and we know this is not terribly big news to you, but is that it isn't a good idea to look at these budgets in isolation necessarily. There are connections between them all. As an example, the general fund, which was the subject of one of the radio ads, there are, if you look at it in isolation, there may be growth factors that look excessive, but if you look at the details behind it, you see that Measure 5, for instance, shifted school funding into the general fund. We know you are aware of that. And also that there are voter initiatives that play a role in whether budgets grow or shrink. And the overall picture needs to be borne in mind in the connections between other budgets and tax methods. As one way to get sort of a grounding in this, we'd like to point to the some statistics that say overall Oregon's tax load has dropped in the 1990s. The U.S. Census Bureau data shows that total state and local taxes dropped from 11.4% of statewide personal income in 89-90 to 10.7% in 96-97. So a decline over time in the income tax load. And similarly, property taxes went from 5% of personal income in 89-90 to 3.4%, so in 96-97 in the same time frame. That's just an indication of what is happening with overall tax load. What other considerations for the committee we hope you'll bear in mind as you look at this issue is the effects of ballot measures on budgets, both kinds, cutting measures, ballot measures that cut taxes, as well as ballot measures that increase demands. The cutting kind you're well familiar with, and increasing demands, Measure 11 is an example of that. And the effect of demographic changes. Not only is our population increasing overall, but which increases a certain demand for services. But within our overall population growth, there are changes that require, for instance, an aging population that require an increased focus and increased service loads or services for to take care of the needs in that population and in the safety net. A final couple of points. The Legislative Revenue Office's packet has taken a look at Oregon compared to other states, and one of the summary statements in that document that you're probably somewhat familiar with is that this state has a relatively low tax burden overall. It relies heavily on the personal income tax. That's nothing new to you. But its reliance on non-tax revenue sources, especially revenue from the federal government, is growing. And this is an issue that we think needs to be borne in mind. Finally, just one concluding statement is we think this issue of government growth is easy to oversimplify. Many factors do play a role, and they do not lend themselves to easy formulas or rigid limits. Ultimately, it seems that good decisions about government growth and government spending come out of careful deliberation, and we know that you all are involved in that and hope to inspire the rest of the legislature to also do the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Williams. I represent the Oregon School Employees Association and am here today on behalf as well with the Fiscal Education Project. Let me also add that we as a coalition appreciate the pressures that have been placed on you as a legislature and in particular as a revenue committee by the voters throughout the years, and that we believe our message needs to extend beyond these walls and continue past sine die. And to that end, let me assure you that the Fiscal Education Project has made it a goal of its group to take that message to the citizens of Oregon and continue to educate people about the unique responsibilities and realities of Oregon's revenue system. But in conclusion today, let me just wrap it all up and to say that we believe that for the reasons we've stated, our current tax system is poorly designed to give us what we want from it, both sufficient and stable resources and revenues. We realize that rethinking and changing our tax system overall will take time. In the meantime, we need to stop creating new problems for ourselves. That is why we call for at least a temporary end to any revenue reductions. Again, thank you for giving us this opportunity to come before the committee, and we'd be happy to field any questions.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, in my area, in the district that I serve, the economy is definitely on a downturn. Private industry is laying off people, and our unemployment rate is very close to double digit in that area. Do you think it's fair that private industry share all the burden in a downturning in economy? And shouldn't government play a role in that too?
Mr. Chair and Representative Brown, we think the government does play a role in that. As the economy declines, generally there's also a decline of government revenues, especially in a state that has such a heavy reliance on property taxes, on the income taxes. So we think there's an automatic effect. And we also think that in terms of political realities, there is an effect as well.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have three or four questions, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Lori, I heard you say 54% of every tax dollar collected actually funds core services. Could you explain that, please?
Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, actually I said 46 cents is left over after 54 cents is given away because of the various tax expenditures currently on the books.
Okay, but you're saying fund core services. These so-called tax expenditures never belonged to the government, did they? They belong to the taxpayers.
Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, I guess that would be a philosophical question in to the extent that the dollars collected on paper anyway come in, the tax expenditures represent legislation passed to give tax breaks to individual segments of the population, whether to stimulate the economy, to stimulate certain behaviors that you hope to derive with incentives. There have been various different reasons for those tax cuts over time.
Let me ask my question maybe a little more directly. This 54 or 46%, and I don't remember which side you had this on. The question is, did those dollars ever belong to the government, or did they belong to taxpayers?
Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, I think that government is all the people, and that simply functions as a means of collection, routing, and paying for the services Oregonians have asked for. I'm not sure.
Well, I'm making the fairly simple point, I think, that these tax expenditures were never government money, so they weren't spent by the government. These were dollars that taxpayers, because of the statutes of this state, or because of adoption of federal statute relative to taxes, that we have made the conscious decision to let the people keep these dollars they earned. So they weren't dollars that we spent giving them their money back. It's dollars that they owned. That's the point I'm making. So we didn't spend these dollars. We didn't collect these dollars. We didn't spend the dollars. If we didn't collect them, we didn't spend them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, if I could also take a stab at that question. I think the issue that we're trying to look at, too, is sort of the extent of the tax base. And the more legislation passes that exempts certain populations from a broad-based tax, whichever kind, property or income or others, that the fewer people are left in the base to then carry the tax.
Oh, that's a different issue, and I'd like to ask a question about that issue, actually. The statement was made, tax cuts mean others have to pick up a bigger portion of the load. Is that necessarily true? I mean, tax deductions or tax credits might be a way of saying we want to limit government to this size. It's not a question of someone big picking up these additional dollars. Maybe there's a conscious decision here that that's as big as we want government to be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I think ultimately taxes and size of government are always a political decision, and that can factor into it. I think in reality what happens is also that when cuts are made, that there is a desire by some people, at least in the process, to continue the service level in some form, and by others not to. So it's not necessarily a unanimous decision.
No, I'm simply making the point. It's not necessarily a decision that other people have to pick up the load. We may be saying this is as big as we want government to be. Finally, we were told that Oregon is way down the list in terms of tax burden. Do you know where Oregon is in the 50 states when you look at taxes and fees in combination as a percentage of income in the ranking of the 50 states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I was going to make copies of this before the hearing but didn't get a chance to because the copier was broken downstairs. But according to this census report that we have here, on a per capita basis of total taxes, Oregon is 35th in the ranking.
Well, does that include fees?
I would have to think of that.
No, that doesn't.
Does not.
And well, not Mr. taxes and the information that Rich passed out on that shows the Oregon revenue for 95-96, 45% of revenue is taxes, as you pointed out. When you do add those other categories, federal aid and charges and miscellaneous revenue, which are the other census categories of general revenue, I believe it's 13th is where we
were. We're 13th of the 50 states. I thought we were 12th, so that's pretty close. I'll accept 13th. The reality, some people in this building are telling us that suddenly we've become a tax heaven in Oregon. When you look at the total tax burden on Oregonians and you include all taxes and fees, we are not. And I think what Mr. Warner's statistics shows that we're 13th out of 50. Finally, if I can make
one more, yeah, I don't want to spend too much more time on that.
I heard that by passing tax breaks, we're creating new problems for ourselves, and I have a real problem with that. We're trying to address constituent needs. I've introduced a bill to provide a credit of up to $1,500 for families where someone leaves the workforce, it stays at home full time to provide care to a dependent family member who needs care in basic functions like dressing themselves and feeding themselves. Now, what your suggestion is here is that we shouldn't pass those kinds of credits. And, I heard what Representative Brown said, and I agree totally. We're trying to address needs that people have out there relative to their jobs, their homes, their families, trying to promote good environmental practices, good energy conservation practices. Your request is that we ignore all of that. I would like to hear a response to that, please.
I'll take it, Mr. Chair and Representative Witt. We actually appreciate that struggle and the good intentions that are behind many of the proposals that are brought forward. In fact, some of them are near and dear to my heart personally, given the hat I used to wear in this building. That does not mean that we have an infinite number of dollars to give away. And frankly, it takes 50% plus one to give away revenue that would otherwise be coming to state or local governments through property taxes or income taxes, corporate taxes, or what have you. It takes a 3/5 majority of each house bring new dollars in. And I think that fact is often lost on this building. A lot of folks with a lot of good intentions, they're like different patches of material in a large quilt, but none of you are sewing them together, it seems sometimes. And the best intentions of the world simply can't be enacted if, in fact, the pot of money that's left to split is too small to fund the ambitions of this same body in other respects. And that lack of kind of comprehensive and unified vision sometimes, I think, puts those of us who are at the service provider in the crossfire. And it's been very frustrating over the years to try to communicate that point.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've been exploring in this committee a number of different scenarios around economic downturn, recession scenarios or whatever, and looking for more stability with taxes, so sort of more getting back to that conversation. Sitting on Ways and Means, I recognize what's going on in the human resources sector. When you pull the education sector and public safety, I think you have well over 90%, almost 95% of the general fund budget. Can you speak a little bit, I know, Laura, you know, from the education perspective and Rich perhaps from the human services perspective, does the demand for service actually go down in economic downturn times? I'm asking a question that's playing the devil's advocate here. Or can you explain kind of what the demand is on the system during times of economic downturn?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, as you would expect, the demand actually for services, especially safety net services, tend to increase as poverty or job loss occurs. And that's intuitively clear that would be the case. The question still remains a political question, whether Oregonians in general or the legislature in particular views it as its role to provide government services to deal with that safety net demand. But I think the fact is that the demand increases in a downturn.
And Lori, from an educational perspective, are there implications for schools in times of economic downturn?
Chair Shetterly and Vice Chair Carlson, I think that the question's a softball across the plate. Thank you.
Well, you got everyone out in the outfield.
I'm not even a sports fan. I should probably stay away from those metaphors. It is absolutely true that we hear anecdotally all the time from our members about students who come to school hungry or you know, and in times of high unemployment or other kinds of economic distress, those same problems that we all know exist in society in general are exacerbated. And students come into those schools with reflecting those family and community realities. And frankly, the schools do oftentimes find themselves providing those services. It can be as simple as the educational ramifications of a generation of drug-affected babies and the educational needs they bring with them in the door when they get to school, to a little bit more subtle and less directly nexus problems. But they are at the schoolroom door, and they do, in fact, exacerbate the problems. And then there's also the case that as populations move and shift and you have swelling class sizes or you have a lot of migrant children, that is to say children who go to more than one school in any given school year, and all of those other kinds of problems, those are challenges to adequately educating those kids inside the classrooms. And those all have bearing on the way we provide educational services and also the cost of delivering them.
Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try not to belabor this any further, but I guess what surprised me about this approach is that you've approached it with all new ideas essentially are bad, and you don't want us to do anything new, which leaves us with the assumption that all current ideas in the system are appropriate, and you made no distinction or determination among any of these choices, so you're putting every one of these tax credits simply on the same footing. And I find that either naive or blatantly simple, because you don't think we're capable of making a rational public policy choice. And I'm a little, I guess, offended at the approach that you've taken on this, and I'd like to hear you respond.
Briefly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, I think we wanted to make a statement. It's true. I'm sorry it feels offensive to you. What actually we, as Lori said in her introduction, what seems logical to us is if a overall package gets put together that makes a new tax cut here but provides for additional revenue somewhere else, that's something that makes sense, and you know, if there's in the context of an overall package, things can be done. But we're just pointing out that there are consequences to these cuts that result in services getting lost to other people somewhere, even when a tax cut might be beneficial to a whole new group of people, and we certainly understand that. But we're, any other given day, we would certainly be looking at many of the proposals as good policy.
Mr. Chair, if I may?
What?
There's a sign in a lot of office buildings that say, show me the money, or something like that. And I think it's along the same line as that reasoning, that with respect to new programs or new promises.
I just have the Chair's prerogative. One last question, Rich. I've got to ask. You mentioned the pressure that comes in from the initiative, both on the revenue reduction side and also on the appropriation side. Did you and your organization support the Long-Term Health Care Commission initiative?
Representative Shetterly, as you know, we did.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's actually a carefully put together package that allows for very slow, deliberate, careful evaluation of new proposals that cost money.
It does create a demand on the budget.
It creates a demand that the legislature can review.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll finish with that. I won't ask the Batman what he wants to do. Oh, David, did you want to?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Okay, with that then, let me move into House Bill 3942. We'll open a public hearing on that. We've got Gary Carlson to bring back up to the bat seat. But first, Paul, you had the recession scenarios you wanted to present to us. Please.
Mr. Chair, we've run through just some hypothetical simulations similar to what we had looked at back early in the session to put together what we thought were plausible scenarios other than the baseline. We're not suggesting the baseline is any less likely. But if you should very much be aware of the sensitivity of the system. If you look at scenario A, I've put that together as what I've referred to over the years as the average recession. That's the case in which income falls 5% below expectations. I'm not talking about declining nominal income, but a situation in which we fall 5% below the long-term average income and below the forecast. The income converges to the forecast after a two-year period. And then the other element to this is we've talked a lot about the importance of capital gains to our system. By the way, we got some new capital gains data since I ran the initial scenarios that showed we were way underestimating capital gains in 99. They're actually over $5 billion. They're about 15% higher than what we had been assuming. So that got built into the March forecast, but it also shows the sensitivity of the system. Those capital gains now we are estimating in terms of the current biennium are making up well over 10% of personal income tax revenue. So what I've done in this scenario is knock 25% off of the capital gains income, assuming a bear market over a four-year period. 25% would be pretty typical of an extended period of weak stock prices. Basically, what that would require is for the Dow and the Nasdaq to stay about where they are for a couple of years, and I think we'd see those kind of losses. Corporate profits fall 20% below forecast, again, not unusual at all in a downturn, and then they snap back 20% in 2003-2005. When I run that through the current system, that's my box there in the upper left-hand corner, I've got 99.01 exactly the same as the March revenue forecast, leaving $488 million carry forward, and that becomes part of the beginning balance for 0103. And then I've assumed made those economic assumptions, and what happens is the net fiscal position goes from, by the way, the net fiscal position now is not zero. I haven't adjusted for the March forecast. The net fiscal position under current law is minus 98. So we would go from minus 98 to minus 883. I haven't made any of the adjustments that the governor recommended in his rebalance. So it's minus 883 would be the size of the gap from an average recession again. And of course it's 2 years. And then basically what happens in 2003-2005, we return essentially to the long-term growth path, but you're still stuck with that gap. I mean, you don't grow fast enough to come out of it. And the primary reason is that that those capital gains stay low in the forecast and you return to average growth. So in that sense, it's a somewhat pessimistic scenario. You don't have a strong recovery. You just have a return to trend growth. Under the system proposed in HB 3942, the gaps are not as big. They certainly do have a fairly large net negatives in the fiscal position. There's a couple of things to keep in mind. One is there is more money in the HB 2942 system in 0103 because of the assumptions we've made from the static revenue forecast we looked at last week. There is a roughly $150 million more in revenue in that system. If you look at the very bottom line, the DIF line, that's the difference between the baseline under the two systems and the recession scenario. So under the DAT system, you lose $524 million versus $685 under the current system. And then in 0305, you lose $548 under the BAT system versus $710 under the current system. There are two major reasons for the difference. One is that I've assumed that the BAT is less responsive to changes in the economy. It still responds, but it is less responsive than the income tax because it does not include some of the more sensitive components, particularly business income. It's basically labor income, rent, and interest paid plus depreciation, so it's a more stable base. So I have it dropping less than the income drops off in the personal income tax. The other key element that makes a difference there is that you see capital gains are a lot lower in the BAT system. That's because of the lower rate. You get a 5% rate here. And that 5% rate means that you're going to collect less revenue. But it also means that ultimately the system is less dependent on capital gains for revenue. That's been substituted for by the BAT. And the result is that the system as a whole is not nearly as sensitive to those fluctuations in the capital gains. And that's, from my professional judgment, as I look out over the next couple of years, that's by far the greatest risk to the revenue system right now is that capital gains income stream, the greatest potential source of volatility over the next couple of years. So in that mild recession scenario, you're looking at about $160 million less in response in the 0103 period than you are in the current system, and about $160 million per biennium less in terms of its responsiveness under these conditions.
Yes, Representative Carlson.
Are all of the different components of this package figured into these numbers, the refundable credits and those set in the personal tax rate? Is this just replacing the corporate tax with the business activity tax?
Representative Carlson, those are all figured in there. The personal income tax, notice my TIT minus K gains there, the personal income tax minus capital gains, is a lot less because of those components of the package. Now, we have not run this through OTIM. OTIM is not a cyclical model. OTIM is a long-term equilibrium model. But you would get, as we indicated by our OTIM run on Friday, you'd get some positive economic feedback in terms of investment and employment that would offset some of this as well, particularly in terms of the moving to the BAT system and reductions in capital gains and taxes on capital.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul, if you had a strong economy moving the other way, in other words, jobs are growing, incomes are growing, current system would tend to give you more growth than 3942, and somewhat in a similar proportional way as it gives you, as 3942 gives you greater revenue in a recession?
That's correct, Representative Witt. I did.
It's less elastic in both directions.
Elasticity means just response to changes in the economy, and this system is less elastic. I mentioned on Monday that I had gone back through and created a rough estimate of the BAT system historical time series compared to the current system. And the current system had an elasticity of 1.23. Well, some of that was clearly due to the capital gains piece, whereas the BAT's base system had a 1.1 elasticity.
So would it be true to say that those who are concerned about government growing at too rapid a pace might take more comfort in this tax system because it tends to moderate the growth of government in stronger economic times? Of course, some of that's reflected now in the kicker, I guess, but probably only a portion of it.
That's correct, Representative. One of the things, and there's very many interesting aspects about the kicker, but I think one of them is that it is a temporary tax cut. It does not permanently reduce the income tax base. So if you have an extended period of strength, such as we had in the 90s, then you are continually seeing that base grow. And you've seen the charts on the personal income tax and how strong it grew in the 90s, and that was not due to any legislation. That was just due to the responsiveness of the system. I will say, I think that the combination of factors in the 90s in terms of rates of change are unlikely to be seen again for a good while, particularly the percentage increases and capital appreciation in the stock market. I just can't see that happening again for a while. But that's certainly the case. A less elastic system, if you don't change it and you come back and look at it under normal growth over a 20-year period, it's going to have a smaller relative tax burden.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Pass.
Paul, would you say the stress on business under 2942 is greater, less than, or equal during a recession than under the current system in terms of ability to pay taxes?
Representative Hass, there is clearly an element here of shifting risk from the public to the private sector. What you've done by what you would do under this system by broadening the base is, and going to, as we talked about, a really benefit principle of taxation, businesses would be paying taxes based on their activity. And when you go into recession, no matter, many very successful, many large corporations end up with losses. And under a loss with a net income tax, net corporate profits tax, they don't pay anything for that year. So this does shift that some of that risk onto the private sector. There's no doubt about it. The public sector has a more stable stream of revenue. The private sector has a more steady stream of tax burden. I mean, that's the flip side of it.
I'm going to pause it. It was as difficult as it was in the 80s to respond to that on the public service and sector side, as difficult as it was in the 80s to respond to that decline in revenue, it's going to be harder if that situation in the broader economy occurs again, or now we have, in post-Measure 5, the burden of the K-12 school system riding on the general fund revenue as well. We didn't have that in the 80s.
Mr. Chair, that's certainly true. I don't think you can argue that the revenue, that the general fund is more elastic than it was in the early 80s. It's probably about the same. We've actually flattened the rates a bit, but it's actually pretty much the same in terms of its elasticity. But the general fund does a lot more. It funds 70% of schools around 30%, so the consequences are different. That's certainly the case. In terms of the economy, I think you can make the case that the economy is probably more stable than it was at that time. But the revenue system, in terms of the components, again, the capital gains piece, is much more of a factor now than it was back in the early 80s.
Representative Bates, I just had a question that's already a follow-up on Representative Hass. And it's also something I've been hearing about. I was getting letters back now about the VAT tax. For a business that's doing $1 million a year or $2 million a year and they've not turned a profit yet, they're going to have a tax on them they haven't had before. And the question that brings to my mind is this tax going to jeopardize their ability to continue as a business? And what I look for is, other models of this tax that we can look at and see what the effect has been. In the United States, there's probably not such a thing, but there are similar taxes in them in foreign countries. And has this been an impediment to new companies or to companies that were struggling staying in business, or is it something they adjust to with time when they understand that's part of their overhead?
Representative Bates, I guess I wouldn't feel comfortable answering that. You know, I think of the European system where we're familiar with the VAT and how it operates there, and the institutions there are so different. They clearly are less favorable environment for business startups in Europe. I mean, we don't see the kind of the amount of small business formation in Europe that you see in the United States. And that varies everything from labor regulations, from regulations in general, to the fact that there's a whole different culture in Europe than there is here. So I don't think we can attribute that to the tax system. So I guess I don't know of evidence that it would discourage it. Again, it goes to a benefit-based principle, which many economists would argue that you see in a big element of property taxes is a benefit tax. I mean, that's property taxes have that same principle that you know, whether you make a loss or not, you got to pay your property tax if you own valuable property. So it's similar in that sense and those property taxes are really a benefit approach, paying for the services that you would consume as long as you're in operation.
I guess that idea. Before we go too far down that road to the European model, too, though, there's not a... One question is the system. The other one is the overall tax burden, which is going to be substantially higher. I mean, what are some of the rates you'd find in the European country? 70%?
Well, overall taxes in Europe run around 40 to 45%. The U.S. are running the low 30s for total state, local, federal burden. It is lower.
All right. Do you want to take us to the next page, and then we can let's get some witnesses up here.
Okay. Just briefly, scenario B is I wouldn't call a worst case scenario, but it certainly would be a recession along the magnitude of the early 80s. Again, the early 80s problem was it was two biennia in a row that you had basically very severe shortfalls in revenue. But the economy entered severe recession. They got income 10% below forecast rather than 2% below, rather than 2% in the other scenario, rather than 5% in the other scenario. Oregon capital gains income falls 40% rather than 25% in the other scenario. Profits fall 30% and then grow 20% in the following biennium. The current system responds very sensitively to those kinds of conditions, and you open up a gap of $1 billion. Again, remember, you know, a gap of $1 billion is obviously would be an enormous a budget crunch, but again, that baseline budget is up to $12 billion. So, I mean, now you're looking at if you're going to lose 5 to 10% of your revenue projection, you're going to get close to $1 billion fairly quickly. $1.2 billion is the gap in 2003-2005 as the system comes back. And again, capital gains don't come back, but income and corporate income starts to come back. In the VAT system, it is less responsive there because, we don't have the 40% drop in capital gains. Doesn't carry as big of an impact as you see in the current system because it just isn't as important a factor in the revenue stream. The BAT, I've assumed, drops off by the same rate as income does and comes back at the same rate as the non-capital gains income does. So it's more closely ties that not to the non-capital gains income effects. So the net result in the BAT system is that you do have a sensitivity there that's roughly $250 million less than you see under the current system. Again, you're going to be looking at some very severe budget problems and that kind of a recession. It's a matter of degree. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be quite as severe.
Gary Carlson, why don't you come on back up? When we finished on Monday, Gary had just concluded his testimony, and Representative Witt, I think, had a couple of questions. I'd first invite you to make any further comment if you have any more, and then committee questions of Mr. Carlson.
I'm at your disposal.
Okay. I've got one. Gary, you've on one, I think you mentioned it, and it's in your printed testimony. Refer to the VAT in one respect as a hidden sales tax, but then on the next page regarding business in Oregon, that if their tax burden is increased, they cannot pass that tax increase along in the price of their product. How can it be both?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Gary Carlson, Associated Oregon Industries. It can't be both for the same business, I guess, was my point. With some businesses who are in a price-taking situation, particularly the traded industries, manufacturers who are trading in a worldwide market, will have difficulty. I won't say it's impossible. We'll have difficulty passing along this new tax burden. For those who are operating as wholly within the state, particularly small businesses, Oregon is heavily dominated, as you know, by small businesses operating on Main Street. Yes, I think you can make the case they will have the ability to pass that along. They won't like it, but they would arguably have the ability to pass that along, with some exceptions. I can't remember if I mentioned this one, but I had a call from a longtime member of ours who's in the retail business, True Value Hardware, which is a nationwide chain. And they get their you've probably been to True Value, and you get their flyers, their sale flyers come out about every 6 weeks or 8 weeks or thereabouts. And those are printed nationally. This business owner, member of ours, said, you know, we have no ability to adjust those prices because those are printed nationally and distributed nationally to all their franchisees. So item goes on sale, it goes on sale. And they simply eat this new tax burden, particularly, I mean, on those kinds of situations.
Like the dynamic impacts we saw, though, from at least OTIM suggesting that sort of eating, but certainly that there was an element there of reduced labor cost, as I recall, too. I mean, there are other ways for tax burden to go than just prices.
In reduced labor costs. In respect that labor could be...
cost less, according to the... Mm-hmm.
Well, what OTIM shows, if you think about tax incidence and tax shifting, it can be either shifted on into higher consumer prices or shifted back into lower wages. And what OTIM is showing is that there is a significant amount of backward shifting on the wages because people are willing to work for lower gross wages because their net income is higher.
Mr. Chair.
Representative, let me see, I think I had Representative Witt's hand up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary, this issue we just talked about before you came up, namely the elasticity of the tax, do you see any benefit here or an argument in support of going to this proposal on 3942? Because it would arguably or should slow down the growth of tax revenues in stronger times and thus implicitly restrain spending increases?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, there is always a tremendous amount of pressure for spending in the legislative process, as I'm sure you're all aware, and I've seen it for a long number of years. Not having the money certainly would help hold down the rate of growth, but I don't think it would necessarily follow that it would necessarily preclude the growth rate from staying the same or something akin to it. In other times, other legislatures, certainly taxes have been increased to satisfy the spending demands that have come into the legislative process. So I'm not certain that it would result in fact, a more tempered rate of growth of government spending.
If I can follow up, Mr. Chairman. Gary, it seems to me, and of course you've been around this process longer than me, but it seems to me both from an observer and then as a legislator, that the growth in government spending in the 90s has largely been a result of the dollars being there, not the legislature affirmatively going out and passing tax increases, which I think is actually fairly hard to do. And, of course, we've got the 60% requirement on tax increases. So, I mean, based on that, don't you see some value here? Because it would tend to limit or restrain the dollars that would come in here that we can spend in stronger economic times and thus would force more efficiencies into state government.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, that may be true. I think it depends, though, in the end, in terms of who the electorate sends to this assembly. I mean, I've seen that over the years.
But that can be said in the current system. I mean, we could raise
certainly is true. And I think also there are ways that revenue can be raised. Of course, this is the art of politics. If revenue is to be raised, there are ways to raise relatively small amounts of money with, use the old sage phrase of maximizing the extraction of down with Lisa and I hissing from the goose. There are certainly ways to raise significant money, but in ways that only impact a relatively small proportion of the populace and thus minimizes the outcry from those who are going to have to pay a higher tax load. So those options, I think, are always available.
Just want to remark that Jim Craven obviously was not here on Friday because Monday because he laughed at that line. It's an old joke. He used it on Monday.
That's one of my favorites over the years, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hess.
Thank you. Gary, you may have noted this. If you did, I missed it. But on your true value model, would it be possible that that store might be in business because there's no sales tax in Oregon? Therefore, that may get... I mean, that's also a factor here. You can't...
Mr. Chair, Representative Hess, that could certainly be true if you're a border town retailer. Where this particular retailer is located would not be a factor.
Mr. Chair, I would respectfully disagree. If you're buying an air compressor for $700, that may, if it's $800, someone might not be able to afford to buy one, but without a sales tax, it's $700, and therefore, a 7 or 8% increase in price might keep customers away, whether it's inland or in the border.
Ribs of Hass, you have referenced someone driving, for example, long distance to save that tax. Was that your point?
Well, I would just submit that a sales tax is an equal factor in what's left out of your model.
Perhaps your staff can answer that. I agree with you in terms of the phenomenon of people evading, if you will, the tax of their home state from Washington, California, or Idaho, making it worth their while to travel some distance into Oregon to buy something and evade, because that's really what it is. They're supposed to report those items, of course, and pay sales tax on them in their home state as a use tax, but it's really evasion when that is done. There may be some data, I'm not sure, that in a state without a sales tax like Oregon, that there's higher general consumption. I'm not sure.
Representative Bates.
I'm sorry we had to disrupt your testimony from last time. This time, so I probably lost some of my train of thought too. Chair, I'd like to ask some questions. Sure. Well, are we going to get there? The basics of this thing is to try to stabilize taxes in the state of Oregon. And I want to know if you agree with that as a basic principle. I mean, even business has to admit that there are certain infrastructures built by the state, whether they be highways or roads or telecommunications, whatever. That have to be looked at, and knowing that was supposed to be supported by taxes, would you not think that stabilizing a tax structure in Oregon is important? We are the most dependent state on income taxes in the country, and we would put ourselves at risk being that way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, as a general rule, government is our services. Largely. It's not entirely true. Of course, you're building highways and bridges and so forth with a portion of government revenue, but basically government is services. If you look just at one component, which we're all very concerned about, and that is education, it is approximately 85%, talking about K-12 now, it's approximately 85% compensation, whether it's benefits or wages, about 85%. So, I think the issue of stability really comes down to one of the ability of the managers of those systems in hard economic times to control expenses. And I think in the system as we know it today in our state, and certainly in many states, it's very, very difficult in economic downturn for the managers of public schools to control their expenditures. They're under labor contracts. I think virtually all of them across the state are under labor contracts, perhaps 2, perhaps 3 years long, and are committed to certain increases year after year, whether or not the resources are there from the economic support base that provides the tax dollars to pay for those services. That, I think, is the crux of the issue with regard to stability.
And that also brings us back to the reduced demand for the labor component of the OCHIM model. And that does reduce labor costs according to OCHIM. So it seems to work in the right direction in that respect.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure it would work in terms of the economic environment, the labor environment of government services.
Yeah, Representative Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gary, you said, I think it was sort of a lighthearted remark, but I just follow up, I guess. You were talking speaking with Representative Witt, that one of your concerns was about the composition of the legislature, and that your concern, of course, half serious, is that this tax, some future legislature might increase this tax. I guess, is that your, I'm trying to get a sense of whether that's your primary concern or whether it's with the tax itself. I mean, if the current or, let's say, last legislature, the previous legislature's composition were enshrined in the Constitution, would you support this stabilizing revenue source? Or are you, that is your really your greatest fear? I mean, ultimately, is it really the whims of the political system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, no. It was more of an observation than it was a reflection of concern of our members about this proposal. I think the concern of our members about this proposal, as outlined in the testimony, were a 2.6, almost $2.7 billion new tax in the state of Oregon, offset by tax reductions in the corporate income tax, elimination of $1.1 billion, and on the personal side, modest rate reduction on general income and a reduction from 9% to 5% in the capital gains rate. That the first element, the $2.6 billion of a heretofore new tax to Oregon businesses, and how that would impact various segments of the business community, all represented in our membership, the manufacturers that are heavily exporting out of the state, particularly those that are heavily exporting internationally, is one area of concern. Those firms who see in this, I think, understandably so, a substantial new tax load. There, other than the modest rate cut and the capital gains reduction, they see a substantial additional tax burden being proposed on their business operation and on them personally, since they're not paying corporate income tax. They're taking whatever profitability there is to their own 1040 in Oregon return, and they see a substantial additional load on that activity, which is as it's intended. It would be passed through in prices, but as I also mentioned in my testimony, that is not something that business people like to do. Business is generally in a competitive environment, and they have to try to maintain that edge in order to remain viable.
Mr. Chair, yep. Separate question. Maybe you got it this last, or whatever that was, last week. When was it this week?
Well, that was Monday. Started Friday, did it on Monday.
Monday.
Okay.
Groundhog Day.
refresh my memory. Did your association support the previous two sales tax proposals that came from the legislature?
Mr. Chair, President Beck, we opposed the 1993 measure because it had a split property tax roll as a component of it.
Okay.
One prior to that was 85, as I recall, when we supported that.
Would you venture to guess whether 15 years later your association would support a sales traditional sales tax along the lines of the 85 proposal?
I would speculate, Representative Beck, that we probably would.
So that type of, Chair, I'm just trying to get sort of sense of what you would support a more of a sort of old-fashioned, pre-modern economy sales tax going up.
I couldn't answer that question with a yes or no.
Yes. And Representative Beck and committee members, I completely understand the positive attributes of this proposal in terms of its broad net, its broad impact. I think those are attributes, are generally favorable attributes of that proposal, particularly with the economy as it's changed and is changing at a very rapid rate in terms of how we do business, how we do commerce, the internet being probably the best example, you know, just one. So I think the concept is an interesting one, has merit for consideration. But as you also mentioned, the concerns about what impact it might have on Oregon's economy is what drives us at this point to say, not right now. Let's slow down. Let's, you know, take a hard look at this before we move ahead.
One final sure. question. Is there enough here in this creative proposal that you could sit down with the chair or whomever and craft something that was you would be neutral on? I mean, are there enough good ideas here and enough of the bad ideas could be tweaked enough to help us find or march into a new tax system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, I guess the bottom line is we're willing to talk about anything. And as I tried to communicate to you, hopefully in my testimony, and certainly to the chair earlier, and your staff, this is a huge proposal, and I think in fact I may have mentioned to one of you earlier in the session, something like this would normally start at the end of one session for consideration the next session, and it may not make it the next session. It may be a two-session idea, and maybe that was an unrealistic expectation of reality, but it's a reality that, in my experience, is true.
Well, Gary, let me just let you finish up because I want to bring up our other witnesses, too, but just... And not to ask you to commit to anything, but I think Paul and I and other committee members are keeping tabs of issues. And just to let you know, you mentioned the issue of the competitive, and Representative Witt also asked the question on Monday, I think it was, as to the effect of this on the state exporters, basically, out-of-state sales. And I think we're very much aware of that and are looking for ways to accommodate that without disrupting the fundamental elements of the system. Also, we've heard from the Department of Revenue that they want time. They'd like a January 1 of 2004 start date, which certainly gives lots of time for working out details and developing strategies, both in the public sector and in the private sector. And also on the issue of taxation of pass-through entities, the notion of providing a credit, basically an offsetting credit for the income portion of the BAT against personal income tax. Do those things begin to make you feel a little warmer toward this thing?
Mr. Chair, I can't really answer the question because I don't feel that we have had even sufficient time to fully gauge the depth of attitude within our own very broad membership in terms of types of business they come from, who they are, and what their concerns might be. I'm not sure they understand. I think they don't understand fully what their own concerns yet are because of the scale of this proposal. And to get that reaction, I think would take some time.
Anything else? Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
Let's bring up Jack Monroe, Jim Wall, and Dave Nelson. The insurance guys.
At least a portion thereof. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe, speaking today on behalf of the Independent Insurance Agents of Oregon. I'm joined on my right by Jim Wall, who's an agent in Dallas.
Oh, Dallas!
Yeah.
Dallas!
It was a blatant play for you to bring the Batmobile out.
Imagine that.
Isn't this a small world?
Oh, there goes the bat, Jack.
He's here today representing the professional insurance agents of Oregon and Idaho, and Nelson, you all know, represents a group with a new name, the Oregon Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. I've often thought that the insurance code was complex and arcane. After sitting in this committee for the last week trying to read your handouts and whatnot, I'm now looking forward to going back to the simplicity and clarity of insurance regulation. But
you're welcome to it.
With that having been said, we're obviously in the same position that everybody you've heard from previously is in, and that is we haven't fully had an opportunity to understand the complexity of this measure, nor have we had an opportunity to evaluate how it would affect various members of the associations, all of whom are organized differently and operate at a different level. But with that having been said, we thought, because you're in the fact-finding mode, that it's important to make you aware of something that's maybe unique to the world that we operate in. And that is that, I think as you all know, insurance is a highly regulated business. One feature of that regulation is the fact that companies file rates with the regulator here. And in that rate structure, obviously, is compensation for Mr. Wall and the agents who sell the products of the company. In short, the companies determine what the price, at least for placement, will be, or what our compensation for placement will be. Also, part of that regulatory structure, it works in a way that we have no ability to add a service fee, let's say, to that filed commission rate set by the company. So to the extent that this tax proposal means that there's an increase in the tax burden for, let's say, Mr. Wall's agency, he will have no ability to shift that forward. He will have no ability to shift that forward. And so the only option is for that additional tax burden to be eaten internally, just shifting it backwards in your nomenclature. And so I don't know if there are other regulated entities out there that would have the same limitation, and certainly you've heard from people who already testified that they might be dealing in a market, in a competitive market to certain extent, whereby they couldn't shift it forward if they're involved in international or national markets. But we're, I think, in a somewhat unique position, at least as agents, in not having the flexibility to pass it on. And so to the extent that this concept obviously moves forward, we'll be looking at you and attempting to find, I guess, some way to alter that circumstance and create greater flexibility either within this bill or within our other regulatory structure to accommodate it. So I think that in a nutshell that represents our concern. I don't know if the other two gentlemen have anything to add to that, but we'd obviously be happy to take any questions you might have.
I'll just add we'll put down insurance for another exception.
Yeah, having been around previous sales tax issues were discussed, I know what the it's all about. The snapping turtle.
That's exactly what Tony Van Vliet
recalled.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jack, does the state of Washington exempt sales taxes from insurance policies that are sold in that state?
How about the B&O tax?
There would be no tax in Washington, I believe.
Be no taxes, real light, though. I mean, it's like, what, 0.2%, I think.
Representative, I don't have a direct response to your question. I do not know how other states are accommodate the situation we're in. And in some cases, understand that, you know, historically insurance has been regulated at the state level. And we are part of a sea change now, triggered recently by the passage of Grisham-Lee-Spillane at the federal level, where uniformity, I think, in that industry is going to become the norm rather than the unusual exception. But previously, insurance has been regulated at the state level and regulated in a variety of different ways, and therefore accommodated, I think, in the tax structure in a variety of different ways. But I can't answer your question specifically. Certainly we'll find out the answer, but I do not know how Washington agents handle the B&O tax burden.
I can follow up real quickly. Mm-hmm. Jack, how about offsetting advantages for agents in this bill? Are many of them incorporated? Would they get a break by the corporation tax reduction, the capital gains reduction, personal income tax reduction, so on and so forth?
Again, I think, as I suggested earlier, frankly, we haven't had a chance. We've got people out there organized, in a variety of different ways, and certainly size, large Portland brokerages versus smaller, in some cases, single agent shops in small towns, and I think the impact has been very widely, and we simply have not had the time to do that analysis.
I guess I'd touch on that. This is, I think, a fundamental matter that we're going to deal with as we talk about this. There's the micro aspect of this, and there's the macro aspect of this, and we certainly are going to have to be aware of all the micro impacts, but we're also aware of the micro effects, both of doing this and of doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the documents that Paul passed out last week was a report on state economies performance from 95 to 2000 and from 2000 to 2005. And from 95 to 2000, it showed Oregon at the top of the heap nationally with an 8.4% average annual growth in real gross state product, with a projection for 2000 to 2005 at a rate of 2.8%, and that is the fastest deceleration of any economy in the nation. I guess that raises the macro environment here. How good an environment is it for business when you've got the fastest declining state economy and folks are either migrating out of state to where the economies are better or getting by without things that they otherwise would be purchasing in a more stable and healthy economic environment?
I've been I've obviously been around the building here for a while, and certainly have listened in at some distance to all of the discussions about finding a third leg on the stool.
Well, we're looking for a second leg now. We used to have two until we lost the property tax.
I can certainly appreciate and would find quite commendable your objective, which is to take a system that has only one source of revenue and an uncertain source of revenue over time, and to try and smooth out the peaks and the valleys in that process. But I guess I'm certainly in the position that Eric Carlson, who preceded me, was in, and who spends a lot of time with you and who is far more expert in this area than I am, and that is, this is obviously a concept, a proposal of some considerable size, and it's going to take a lot of us a while to get our arms around it. And certainly, dealing with our situation, there are probably ways to deal with our situation both within the proposal and probably some ways to deal with it outside the proposal in terms of the regulatory structure that we have to respond to. But as that regulatory structure exists today, it would create a problem for us, and we're simply here to identify the fact that it would create a problem for us, and the flexibility would not be there. That might be there for some other folks.
Okay. Either one of you?
Well, for the record, I'm Jim Wall from Dallas. I'd just like to point out that one of the concerns that we have
that
one of the concerns we have as agents is the competitive advantage it would have to those companies who operate from outside of our state borders, that use the 1-800 numbers and the internet websites to transact business in our state, which would give them an advantage over us in that particular transaction. We have great concern about that.
Jim, you were on school board, weren't you?
I was on the school board for 10 years.
Okay. I absolutely appreciate that. I've, your concerns, but I guess, too, I would ask, we're in the situation now where we're the money bags for the school system. We weren't in the 80s when we had the last downturn. And I think for those of us, again, dealing at the macro level, that's a real concern for us, that a downturn now in the economy is going to implicate services, primarily K-12, that were not implicated in the last recession, and how we deal with that.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
for us to solve, not you.
I certainly appreciate that problem, and it is definitely a problem. We simply needed to point out to you how this impacts us specifically, because we are regulated both from the sales side as well as the inability to change or charge any fees to recoup any of that.
Okay. Anything else? This guy's a pro, by the way. He used to go back to Washington, D.C. about every week and testify in Congress. So. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
My name is Chair. For the record, I'm Dave Nelson, representing the Oregon Life Underwriters Association, now known as the Oregon Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. And also I'd like to put on another hat, and that is my agricultural hat, as I do represent the Oregon Seed Council, which is the grass seed producers of the state of Oregon and the Oregon dairy farmers in the state. Let me just ditto what Mr. Monroe said as far as my insurance agent client, and also tell you that he tried to get a fee bill introduced and got shouted down by his own association, so his influence is limited there as well.
Mean.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I was somewhat concerned as Mr. Warder described the end result of the BAT, as it might affect those with limited ability to move prices forward or costs forward or backward. And that certainly, he described the agricultural economy, not only grass seed and dairy products, but virtually every agricultural commodity that's produced in the state, other than perhaps nursery. I don't know about them. They're certainly the only commodity that is above water at the current time that I am aware of. Grass seed has experienced an enormous crashing in the last year, if you will. The price of perennial ryegrass has declined from 58 cents a pound to 42 cents a pound, and is now being offered at 35 cents a pound, and the cost of production at 47 or 48 cents a pound. So farmers are taking a bashing and an inescapable tax, if you will, or adding another inescapable tax in addition to the property tax, is simply another rock to carry across the river in these very, very difficult times. So the position you put the farmer in is just simply how long can you borrow not only your living costs but these additional taxes as you go from year to year until you come out of it. The grass seed industry will probably not come out of it until for another 2 years, until we work off this enormous inventory that was left in the state of Oregon by the financial collapse of AgriBiotech Seed Company in January of, 99 or 2000, whatever it may have been. So these kinds of things, I think, we need to look at them very carefully from the standpoint of how they affect the agricultural economy. If Jack was having difficulty understanding or reading the tax code, somebody ought to try reading how you price milk in the United States. I think there's reportedly three people who understand, and two of them are liars. And so it's just a matter of how you try to figure that out. So we're very concerned. We're interested in the subject. Go slowly.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony today. Jim Craven, we've got you on the list. Do you want to go today, or do you want to wait until Friday?
2 minutes.
2 minutes.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Craven, American Electronics Association, representing Oregon's high-tech industry. I really don't have a lot of, a week ago, my point was to make sure that we understood or were cognizant of the potential impacts of this proposal on our high-value, high-wage manufacturing export members who, in this state, a lot of whom tend to be part of the high-tech industry. I know even your own handouts say the competitive position of these businesses could be put at risk. That doesn't make us early adopters ready to run in here and say, yes, we love this plan. It gives us a certain amount of pause, and I appreciate that you have, that you're wrestling with that and have recognized it. Many witnesses have also already pointed out. Just two other things to throw into the mix. One, there were a lot of bills, and boy, the group that came in here earlier, they had a whole long list of tax exemptions, and I guess if we repealed the corporate excise tax, we wouldn't have to worry about all those other corporate tax breaks, and because they would all become a moot point because there wouldn't be any corporate excise tax, and so we wouldn't have to worry about pollution control tax credits and R&D tax credits and all the rest of them because they just evaporate overnight. I just wanted to sort of say that on the record. Also, I think the corporate kicker, I guess, would evaporate overnight, notwithstanding its hallowed place in the Constitution. If we don't have a corporate excise tax, we don't have a corporate kicker, and we don't have to have that debate anymore. So maybe some benefits of the plan. One further serious comment is that...
Thank you.
Unlike my jovial comments a moment ago, it did bring us a little bit of a pause to hear the economist up here Friday in the original presentation and talking about models and, you know, pure economics or economist kind of analysis to say that, you know, high-value exporters may not be able to reflect such an increase in the price dealing in very highly cutthroat competitive world markets, but that we could just reflect it back in and sort of take it away from the wages for our employees. I don't think that was, again, a really high-confidence sort of message that the way that we would deal with this is reduce the wages of our employees here in Oregon, who are also employees in a national and international competitive economic system. So that wasn't a lot of comfort level to us either. But, you know, we'll continue to monitor your progress, and I think we have a lot of people, a lot of questions. All the questions asked here today are the same questions I'm hearing, and we'll continue to try to ask them and seek answers.
Very good.
Thank you,
Jim. Let me do this. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 3942, and just so we don't lose it, I want to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2717. That's Representative Witt's bill that addresses the policy objectives and values for the state and local tax system. And with that, I will close the public hearing. And now we've had our tap on the bat and Representative Witt, and we are adjourned for the day.